Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices. Welcome back. This is part two of my discussion on wildlife dentistry with Dr. Leslie Reed. In episode 15, we cover Dr. Leslie's origin story, as well as some fundamentals of dentistry, such as dentition, and how and why dental interventions can make or break an animal's ability to thrive in the wild. A side note, this is the final episode for season two. My Partners for Wildlife team members and I want to thank you for continuing to tune in as we grow this podcast. If you like what you hear, we hope that you'll keep telling your wildlife rehabilitation and veterinary medical friends about us. We're already beginning to record and produce episodes for season three, which will start dropping this winter. And that is wherever you get your podcast, you can find it. Can't wait for you to join us then. But for now, let's continue our talk with Dr. Leslie Reed. So we talked a lot about, kind of the dental formula and the makeup of teeth and what a tooth, pieces and parts of a tooth, and dentition and all that, but which is so important for this next part, is to talk about, okay, all that stuff is great, but now I've got this raccoon or this opossum, right, and I need to do a dental exam.
Yes.
So what does that look like for different animals?
Yeah. So honestly, I feel like you cannot achieve a thorough dental exam with an animal that is not sedated.
I wonder why you would say that.
Right?
Why would you say that? Weird.
And, you know, definitely with wildlife. I mean, even with some dogs and cats, it's really difficult because they don't appreciate having their mouth looked in. And so it can be really difficult to get a full assessment of what's going on. So I highly recommend sedation to get a really good look in there. You may be able to kind of lift a lip and be like, okay, yes, I see a broken tooth, but not knowing the extent of it until you get them sedated. So, you know, don't be afraid to do that so that you can get that thorough exam and really know what's happening and what's going on in there. I mean, even things, you know, I mean, when you're looking at rabbits and rodents, their cheek teeth are way back in the back of their mouth. I call it the dark abyss because it gets really difficult. I mean, it is. It's like just a black hole back there, and you really need a good light source and tools to look back at those cheek teeth, and you're just not going to be able to achieve that in a wild animal that's awake. They're just not going to tolerate it.
You can't just say,
Open wide?
Open wide. Opossums you can.
Yeah, no, opossums, yeah.
Opossums are great because their defense is just to open their mouth and, you know, drool at you. And so usually I can get a pretty good visual exam at least of like, okay, yep, I see, you know, a tooth in there that looks, you know, a little bothersome there.
Right.
But again, we want them sedated so that, you know, not only can we better examine the tooth, but then we get a better look at the gingiva. We get a better look for oral masses. If I have fractured teeth, I like to probe them. So that's a little tool called a little probe or explorer that has a little kind of metal tip that we look for pulp exposure. So sometimes we can get fractured teeth that just fractures the enamel or maybe the dentin is exposed. Sure. But we want to know if that pulp is exposed. So we use that explorer to go in there and probe around. And these are just, again, things that you really can't do in an awake animal. So you want to sedate them. And then what I'm looking for once they're under good sedation is I'm examining each and every tooth individually and making sure there's no issues there, looking at the surrounding gums, looking at the tongue, looking under the tongue, looking at the roof of the mouth to make sure there's no foreign bodies there or injuries, you know, and just anything else that would be abnormal for that for that animal. And then, you know, charting, just make good notes, you know, of which teeth are affected. And teeth are also numbered, which I won't dive into that too deep because it can get confusing. But, you know, the quadrants of the mouth are numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then you have individual numbers per tooth. So like 104 is your right upper canine. You know, 208 is going to be your left upper in a dog, fourth premolar. So they are numbered, and there are some great charts out there that talk about the numbering system so that you can get really specific, or you can just be easy and say the left lower canine.
Right.
Might be easier. But, yes, so getting that really full exam is going to be really important while they're under sedation so that you have an idea of what needs to be addressed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that, I mean, that sounds good. And I certainly have seen, you know, with bats, since my specialty is bats, I've seen, you know, and the only time you can sort of see the back is when they're yelling at
you, right?
And they're screaming and so their mouth is open and I try to do my best, but you're exactly right. You cannot.
Right.
And if they're yelling at you, they might yell at you for 5 seconds.
Yes.
And then their mouth is closed.
You get a very brief look.
You get a brief look.
Yes.
And I might get a really good idea of what's maybe going on in the front, like you were mentioning, but those back teeth are
it's just hard, impossible
To see.
Right.
So hence now I'm really understanding why you like opossums.
Yes, I know. They make it, they make my job pretty easy, which is great.
They make your job really easy. Okay. So, so you've got a good dental exam. Now what, you know, you were talking about different things that you're looking for, but let's talk about some of the things that you find.
Yes.
And what might be the path of resolution for those things.
Yes. So one thing that we find the most frequently are fractured teeth. And, you know, oftentimes these teeth get fractured from some sort of trauma. I've seen fractured teeth just from general wear and tear too, or a tooth that maybe is just so worn down that it's down to the pulp. But the fractures are typically some sort of trauma, whether that means the animal traumatized it after they bit on something, or maybe they were hit with something. We have had animals come in, unfortunately, usually opossums that are considered more of a nuisance species that have come in that have been hit in the face with objects like bats and golf clubs. And, you know, sadly, more often than not, it's not accidental that that happens, but usually a good Samaritan finds them and brings them in. So we can see some badly fractured teeth from that, and even an avulsed tooth, which is where the tooth completely dislodges from the root.
Okay.
And so I've seen canine teeth, especially completely avulsed from the root area, and that's a tooth that obviously needs to come out. So looking for trauma to the teeth. We're also looking for tooth decay. We don't see as many cavities in wild animals as we can, and, you know, some of the domestics or in humans, you know, cavities are pretty common because oftentimes we see cavities from bacteria that colonize on the tooth. And oftentimes we get that bacteria from eating a lot of like carbohydrates and sweets and sugars. And our wild animals don't do that. They eat natural things. Right. And so they keep their teeth nice and healthy by eating those natural things. And so we don't see a ton of tooth decay, but there are some captive wild animals that can build up plaque quite easily. And bats are one of those.
Bats are one.
It can get pretty heavy tartar on there. And then that tartar can lead to tooth decay. And then if they get severe enough tooth decay, then we're looking at a tooth that needs to be removed. Mm-hmm. And so those are the two main things that we're looking for. And then malocclusion, which I discussed earlier too. So any teeth that just are not lining up appropriately are going to be what we're looking for the most part. And any evidence of neoplasia within the mouth too.
Right.
Or cancerous tumors.
Right.
Yeah.
You spoke about an opossum earlier that had a tumor in the mouth.
Yes.
Where was it?
Yeah, it was on the lower mandible. Kind of back between the premolars and molars. And it was a really nasty invasive mass that had gone into the gingiva and invaded into the teeth that were living there and the bone. And so we actually found it. She came in for other reasons. She was emaciated, probably from that.
Right.
Had horrible osteoarthritis. She was probably an older gal. We know opossums don't live super long in the wild. And so she came in for some other reasons, and then we found the mass. But you could smell it. I mean, her mouth just stunk. And there was this icky necrotic invasive mass down there. So we did send her to the diagnostic lab for a full necropsy, and they diagnosed squamous cell carcinoma. It was interesting.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And poor opossum.
Yeah, and that's a very aggressive, invasive tumor, so that's not something that, say she came in and only had that as her problem, we still would likely euthanize because it can, it has a high chance of metastasis to other parts of the body and very poor prognosis. So.
Right, poor prognosis and treatment can be very, very...
Yes, and I mean, if this was a domestic animal, the treatment would be a mandibulectomy where you literally remove half of their mandible to get rid of the cancer, and we can't do that in our wild friends. So, you do have to keep that in mind when you're assessing, these dental problems is, okay, what's the treatment going to be, and is that treatment appropriate for a wild animal that I'm hoping to release?
Right. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it.
Right.
So that is the question a lot of times.
Yes.
So, as far as like if you needed to remove teeth, and I know that with the caveat that it's probably species specific.
Yes.
But how many teeth can you remove?
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great question. So it depends on the type of tooth. So if we're talking about incisors, I don't necessarily have a limit on incisors just because those teeth can be used, like I said, for scooping and kind of scraping. But animals do great missing incisors. They can still apprehend food just fine, and they can still hunt just fine. So if we have to remove, several incisors, I'm not concerned about that. The canine teeth are the ones I really worry the most about.
Right.
And those are oftentimes the most common tooth that is fractured. And so if we're looking at an animal like an opossum or a raccoon that's an omnivore or scavenger, I feel very comfortable removing two canines.
Okay.
And, I want them to have something there, more so for defense than anything against other animals. So, but I feel very comfortable removing two canines. If we're talking about a fox or a coyote, I would say one canine.
Okay.
Yeah. If we're looking at kind of more of an apex predator, so say like a bobcat or a mountain lion, I would not remove any canines. They really do rely on those to catch their prey rely on that food. So that's kind of how I gauge how many I'm willing to take. It's sad because sometimes, we have had animals that break their teeth in the live trap coming to us. Or they break their teeth chewing on cage bars in the clinic. And so we need to really make sure that with those animals that are a little more high stress, that we're addressing, their pain, obviously, whatever they're coming in for, make sure their pain is well managed, and that we're addressing their stress and anxiety.
Right.
So if that means we need to use some anxiolytic medications to keep them calmer, to prevent them from further hurting themselves, then that's what we need to do.
Exactly.
So that's kind of my take on, you know, canine teeth. And then with premolars and molars, again, they have so many of them that if they have to lose one or two or even three, I'm not concerned about it. Okay. It's the canine teeth that I'm really worried about. And then with our rabbits and rodents, the incisors. Right. Those are the ones we're worried about. And again, we never remove completely an incisor. If one comes in and it's fractured at the gum line, what I will do is take an x-ray and look for the remaining part of the tooth.
And see if it's
present. If it's there, that's good news that it's likely going to grow back in. We'll just monitor teeth and trim as needed. But if it's completely gone, then that animal really should be euthanized. Yeah.
When you're talking about canines and removing, and you said one versus sometimes two or things like that, especially when it's not all four, right? Do you have a calculation for, can I take, let's say both the upper are broken or both the lower are broken or one of each.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of calculation is that?
So if I'm going to take two, I've taken two uppers, I've taken two lowers, I've taken one of each. Okay. So I guess with the omnivores, as long as they have two remaining canines, that's really what I'm focused on.
Sure.
And then if we're looking at, you know, kind of more towards our stricter carnivores, if I'm going to take one, ideally, you know, their uppers they're going to use more commonly for grabbing prey.
Sure.
But I'm okay removing one upper.
Okay.
Yeah, or one lower. Okay. So, and they typically do really well. So we had a coyote come in that actually had an upper canine, and then almost all of his incisors were broken. Open pulp, his mouth was a mess. Mm-hmm. And so pulled that canine and pulled majority of his incisors, and you know, he did very well, you know, at least in our rehab setting, and I'm guessing he's probably doing just fine.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So.
And they're also very clever, and they eat lots of things. And
They are
very amazing.
Yes.
Amazing animals.
They are.
Okay, so do you see many abscesses, infections?
Every now and then, not as often as we do in domestics.
Okay.
So in domestic, you know, rodents and rabbits, oftentimes they can get nasty infections in their mouth. If they do get a tooth fracture, it gets infected and they get a big old abscess that can develop. I haven't had a lot in wildlife, you know, develop abscesses, but it is a risk to having an open tooth fracture because that open area that's going into the pulp is basically just acting like a portal for bacteria to get up into the tooth, and then it gets up into the root, and then we can see nasty infection come in and abscesses develop.
Okay.
So if anything, maybe I've seen some infection present. As I pull the tooth out, I can see there's some infection up there in the root area, but not any giant abscesses, I guess, at the site of that tooth that's fractured. I will say I do see some more soft tissue abscesses around the mouth or in the jaw of like squirrels for, you know, would probably be the most common that I've seen come in with big abscesses. And so when we have an abscess on the face, we always want to know if it's associated with the tooth, because sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Right.
And so then our x-rays really come in handy to get a better look at the teeth itself and the roots of the teeth, you know, in that area to see if there's bony involvement with that abscess site or if this was just a separate issue.
Right.
So x-rays are great, you know, to have access to those, and even better if you have dental x-ray because it's more detailed. But getting a better look at the surrounding bone around a tooth and the sinuses and, you know, looking at, especially like with rodents, their bottom incisors should go behind the top ones. And so you get a better look at that on some x-rays. So definitely using that as a tool when you're assessing oral pathology is really great.
Okay.
Or if you do have a swelling or mass on the face or on the jaw, you know, it's hard to know if it's invading the bone without an x-ray.
Right.
So getting some skull rads or some jaw rads to assess that.
To help you.
Yeah.
Are there things that you have to be careful of with the teeth when you're using antibiotics, for example, or any other types of drugs to help try to address that? You know, like in eyes, for example, you have to really know what's going on, what the problem is, to what type of product you put in their eye.
Yes, yes. So we always want to be good stewards when it comes to antibiotic use.
Yeah.
So I only use antibiotics if there's a reason to do so. So if we're looking at let's say an animal comes in that just has a tooth fracture, I typically do not start them on antibiotics. Pain meds, absolutely, because that hurts. But I do not start them on antibiotics. And when we extract that tooth, if it was an uncomplicated extraction, I do not put them on antibiotics.
Okay.
And that is pretty standard across the board, even with small animal medicine. Mm-hmm. If an animal comes in and we have infection in the mouth, right, or we have an abscess present, then yeah, that's definitely warranted to do some antibiotics. Or if I have just horrible periodontal disease and there's so much just tartar and right. grossness, you know, getting that infection under control before going in and cleaning up and taking any teeth out. So, you know, then we try to reach for an antibiotic that we know would be appropriate for use in the mouth that has good bone penetration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like clindamycin would be one we'd commonly use. If we have a pocket or an abscess that we can culture, that would be great,
right.
because that narrows down what antibiotics are actually going to, you know, get into that area and treat that infection. And
right.
we're not just kind of like guessing and throwing all these antibiotics at the animal. We really want to try to only use them when necessary and try to use the right one.
Right.
And so if we can get a culture and sensitivity, I will do that. And I'd highly recommend that as well. Sometimes in young animals, we do have to be careful with antibiotics too, because there are some antibiotics, some of the tetracyclines that can actually cause permanent dental issues, such as dental staining.
Yeah. Wow.
And and so we can definitely get some issues with dental stuff with little young animals with certain antibiotics. So again, just doing your research and knowing what's safe to use and what age of animal.
Right. Right.
Yeah, is important.
And of course, the other piece, which I'll make sure gets in the show notes, is that, and veterinarians are very much aware of this, is that if you are working on wildlife that happen to be also a game animal,
absolutely,
you have to be very aware
yes.
of what antibiotics you can
right.
use, when you can use them, if you can use them at all,
right?
In game animals,
because they're considered a food animal.
A food animal.
Yeah, so those food mm-hmm. animal laws apply to those species. Yep. You're absolutely right.
So just another layer of complication.
Yep.
There you go.
Hooray.
Yay. Yay.
Yes.
And you mentioned earlier about congenital deformities,
right.
malocclusions generally.
Yeah.
Are there, so malocclusions are probably the
most common. Yeah. I'm trying to think if I've had any animals come in that have like not developed teeth. And I can't think of an instance that that has happened. So I would say malocclusions, a congenital, you know, malformation of the skull or the jaw would be the most common reason that I would see in young
okay.
or juvenile animals.
Okay.
Yeah, that come in with dental issues.
Yeah.
Now,
here's a question. So mm-hmm. you get in a young squirrel, it's got a malocclusion. You can trim it, but you know
right.
that either that side or whatever
mm-hmm.
is going to continue to grow. So
right.
it's... If so, euthanasia is usually, it's not releasable.
Correct.
Period. So you take
yep.
that off
yep.
the thing. We've got three possibilities for
yep.
wildlife rehabilitation, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've got release,
right.
which is what we all want. We have euthanasia,
yep.
which is often the kindest option.
Yes.
And then we also have placement.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've got a young squirrel that has a malocclusion
mm-hmm.
and you can trim it, it hasn't done any damage to the skull or
sure.
grown into the skull,
okay.
that kind of thing. So we won't say it's really
okay.
bad. What about placing it?
Yeah. You know, I have pretty strict guidelines when it comes to qualifications for placement for animals. So, you know, if we have an animal come in, let's say we get a squirrel and the squirrel's imprinted. Let's say somebody raised it. Okay. They've had the squirrel for 4 months, four or five months. It's imprinted on people. It doesn't have that instilled fear, you know, or that inherent fear. And it has malocclusion, you know, would it make a good placement option? Maybe. I mean, if the animal, that's kind of my biggest thing is, number one, are they going to have chronic pain? If they're going to have any sort of chronic pain, then for me, I would rather euthanize personally.
Right.
Okay. Number two is, are they going to live their life in fear? Okay. So imprints, in my opinion, make a better placement option than an adult that comes in that is terrified of people, is going to be stressed out beyond belief,
right.
living in a cage for the rest
mm-hmm.
of his life. So if it's an imprinted animal, we're not going to have chronic pain. And usually with malocclusions, they're not painful unless it's digging into their face.
Right, right.
They're not painful. But I also want to make sure, is this animal going to receive the proper care that it needs?
Right.
This animal is going to need frequent tooth trimmings. So I would do a little bit more research into where is this animal going? What are their qualifications? Do they have a vet that they're working with if they're not a vet themselves? And are they going to be able to provide proper care for this animal? Because if they're not going to be able to provide proper care, then again, euthanasia is more humane in my opinion.
Right, yeah, you're delaying the inevitable, right?
Yes. So I personally place very, very few animals or recommend placement for very, very few animals.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I was sort of thinking about when you were talking about it is, especially on the other end, right? Mm-hmm. The end of the receiving institution,
sure,
having to have the expertise,
yeah,
the veterinarian availability,
yes,
and all of those things. And then the other thing is, you know, if you've got a gray squirrel, let's say, mm-hmm, let's say this animal is a gray squirrel, how many places want a gray squirrel,
right,
as an education animal?
Right.
Whether on display or whatever.
Yeah.
It's great to be a common species that you've done very, very well in the wild, but mm-hmm, on the flip side, mm-hmm, that if you're trying to place,
right,
it's generally not.
Yeah.
It'd be very difficult to find.
Agreed.
Appropriate placement.
Agreed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you're right, they have to pass a behavioral test. They have, mm-hmm, to, you have to make sure that they would be comfortable,
yes,
as close as we can figure out, right, in captivity.
Right.
And I, of course, for most of my career have been training ambassador animals. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's,
yeah,
like, this procedure has to be done frequently.
Yes.
So what kind of training would I have to do, mm-hmm, to make it as least stressful as possible,
right,
for the animal?
Right.
And it can be done. But then does the receiving, mm-hmm, institution, are they willing? Do they have the,
yeah,
expertise? So there's expertise on a lot of different,
yes,
levels for this.
Right.
And if that particular person who has all that expertise decides to retire or move on to a different job, now what?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I, yes, think certainly best practices over the last 30 years that I've been involved in wildlife, mm-hmm, rehabilitation has certainly shown that we need to be a lot more careful about the placement. And actually, placements,
yes,
have been going down,
yeah,
across,
yeah,
the board,
yes,
which I think is the
too,
right answer,
yes, right,
for,
right,
all the reasons we've just,
absolutely,
talked about.
Absolutely, right.
So,
yeah,
which, you know, unfortunately, I mean, rehabilitation, especially when we're dealing with trauma, but in this case, something like a congenital thing, mm-hmm, that is a gift we can give.
Absolutely.
And,
yes,
and it's a hard thing when we get into, mm-hmm, this profession wanting to save wildlife and release, mm-hmm, them back to the wild. And it's a really, really,
yes,
hard reality.
It is.
But if you also realize that it is kinder.
It is.
Because,
right,
if that animal, that malocclusion,
yeah,
on that squirrel was out in the wild, sure, it might do okay for a while, but then it's,
right,
going to start to get skinny, and,
yep,
then that,
yep,
that tooth is going to, you know, mm-hmm, go into the cheek. Or, I mean, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, yeah. It can, you know, we really have to look at it almost like going into wildlife medicine, not necessarily wanting to save wildlife, but to help wildlife.
Yeah.
And helping wildlife, euthanasia is part of helping wildlife.
Yeah.
If we can't rehab and release back into the wild, we are still helping them by giving them a humane death.
Yes.
And so we really have to just kind of retrain our brains to think of it that way so that euthanasia isn't such a difficult thing. I mean, of course, we want, you know, these animals to succeed, but we also are here to help them have a humane passing if that's what's going to be best for them.
Yeah, I love that. And I love, yeah, kind of reframing it as helping.
Yes.
Because, yeah, everybody is like, release, release, release.
Right, right, right.
And totally get that. We get the, mm-hmm, you know, the dopamine hit or whatever,
yes,
for releasing this,
yes,
animal that we've worked,
yes,
so hard with. But at the same time, this is the reality. And it's...
Yeah. Yeah. And that just comes with time and education, I think. And I agree with you. I'm seeing less animals getting placed. And I think more rehabbers are just receiving the education they need of making better judgment calls,
yeah,
onto what needs to be euthanized and what we should try with. And we've really come a long ways. And I'm really happy to see that because that really is what's best for the animal in the long run. And that's why we're all here.
Oh, exactly.
We want to help these guys.
The other thing that I've noticed too, I've been doing this a long time,
mm-hmm,
is... you know, the mention of pain medication.
Yes.
And,
oh,
the use of,
please,
different pain. Oh my gosh,
yes,
it's been,
yes,
just wonderful,
yes,
to be, you know, that if we would hurt,
yes,
if something like that happened,
absolutely,
to us, we have to assume that they are hurting.
Yes.
Just because they don't show us,
yep,
in a way that we can interpret.
Right. They're much better at hiding.
They're much better at hiding it.
But we should assume that they're...
We know it hurts, right?
We know it hurts.
Like, we're looking at teeth. We know the anatomy of a tooth.
Yes.
It's the same for a coyote as a person. You have enamel, you have dentin, you have pulp.
Right.
If I break my tooth in half, I'm going to be hurting.
Yes.
Okay? So if that coyote breaks his tooth in half, he's hurting.
Right.
Just because he's not complaining about it. Oh, he's still eating. Well, yeah, he's a wild animal. That's a survival mechanism.
Yeah,
he has to
eat.
His alternative is to starve.
Right.
We cannot disregard that animal is feeling pain. And I see that so often. I see it even in dogs and cats. And it's really difficult because they're still eating. They're not acting painful. You know, isn't that just natural for teeth to fall out like that? And it's, you know, again, I take that as a teaching opportunity.
Right.
And relate it back to us. And okay, how would we feel if we had X, Y, or Z going on in our mouth?
Right.
You know, that'd be really uncomfortable. And we would address that. We wouldn't ignore that. So why are we ignoring it for our patients?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, pain meds are definitely something I could go in my soapbox for a whole session on pain management and wildlife.
Ooh, oh my gosh.
So
pain management.
Yes, let's please use pain meds and don't assume they're non-painful because you're not seeing those obvious signs, because they're going to be much more subtle and we need to be their advocate. We know they're hurting.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, we know what we're looking at, and so we need to use our brains and say, yep, you've got a canine fracture and I see your pulp hanging out right there. Let's get you some pain
Let's
management.
Get you some, yeah. And I don't think it's anthropomorphizing at all.
Yeah. No. No.
Because we do sometimes have to assume, right? And to me, that's okay, especially in this case when we're talking about pain.
Yeah.
You get a broken wing, it hurts.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Let's, you know.
You got a broken shell?
That hurts.
Ouch. Yeah, but turtles don't scream. So then people, you know, are like, hey, they're fine. They're still walking around.
They're still walking around because they have no choice. It's a survival thing, right?
Exactly. Right.
So, yes. Yeah, thanks for addressing that
because
higher levels of euthanasia or timely decision making, plus so not placing as many animals, I've seen as a positive change, which seems weird, but I do.
Mm-hmm.
And also this change with pain management, and I have loved it.
Right, me too. And I also see too, you know, some people will have concerns with like dental extractions, and they'll say like, oh my gosh, you're going to pull 5 teeth on this animal. Ouch, that's so painful. It's like, in reality, that animal's going to feel so much better because those fractured teeth were such a source of pain, and I'm going to remove that source of pain. And that animal's going to have some pain meds upon recovery, and they're going to feel great.
Wow, so, that must be so satisfying.
It is, and that's, I think, why I also love doing dentistry so much, is seeing that instant change in that animal and their demeanor, and it's amazing. And so that's why I advocate so hard, you know, for wildlife and for domestic animals, of like, this is a problem and we need to address this, and you would be amazed how much better this animal's going to feel.
That's a little, you know, if you got a broken wing, you can pin it and stuff like that, but it's still going to take weeks.
Right?
Shell. Yeah. Shell of a turtle, months.
Right?
Yes. But,
my
goodness, but tooth extraction.
1 to 2 weeks.
There you go.
You're good.
We're good.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's just, they do great. And the mouth is a very forgiving place, which is really nice because, you know, I guess as a veterinarian, then you feel a little bit less pressure of like, oh, if I make a mistake, I have a little more wiggle room here.
Sure.
And the mouth just heals very nicely. So that's a good thing because it heals quickly. The body just regenerates very quickly in the mouth. And these guys do great. And they usually eat very well. You know, we keep their pain managed for, you know, depending on what tooth came out or how many, 3 to 5 to 7 days of pain management afterwards and monitoring, and then they're typically good to go. So, you know, another question I get frequently too is, you know, oftentimes these animals are not coming in primarily because they have a tooth issue. They're coming in because they were, you know, hit by a car, attacked by a dog, they have lead poisoning, they have other issues going on. And the tooth is just an incidental finding. Like, oh, you also have this going on. So oftentimes we don't address the tooth until the other problems are resolved.
Okay.
So we make sure they're on good pain management, obviously. But then once their other issues are almost completely resolved, then the tooth is the last thing we do, because then once that's healed, they're good to go.
Okay.
So, you know, if we're going to do, for instance, we did an opossum today, you know, she was a lead case, so she's resolving really well. She also had a tail tip amputation. So those were her major problems. The tooth is just, this can wait. But once she got to a point where the doctors there felt like, okay, she's looking really good, we're looking like really soon, then I'll come in, do the dental work, and then she's good to go in a couple weeks.
Right.
So that's the other thing too, is, you know, we typically don't jump to that right away.
Sure.
Until we get everything else resolved.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
The least of their worries, usually.
Worries. Yeah. Do you see, especially with the traumatic injuries, so possum, we're sticking with the possum.
Yes.
Possums, I'm smiling right now. Okay, gets hit by a car, but let's say it doesn't get hit directly in the head.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
So gets hit on its back end or something like that. With something like a raptor, like an owl, for example, if they get hit by a car, again, even if they didn't get hit directly in the head, often there's eye trauma, even because that whole body has to absorb that shock. Do you see that with teeth at all?
Not usually, unless there was direct force to the mouth.
To the mouth.
Yep. Okay. Yep. I oftentimes don't see it secondary to an injury elsewhere on the body. Okay. Yeah, there usually has to be direct impact on their mouth.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's
a good question, though. Yeah,
really good to know.
Yeah, yeah. I have seen, too, you know, speaking of, like, eyes, and they're very close to the mouth and teeth, you know, it's amazing how we've got our sinuses that live right in between our eyes and our mouth, and sometimes that trauma can be so severe on their teeth that we can see the root of the tooth can get pushed up into their sinuses, and then we can get chronic issues with that. So, for example, we had a woodchuck at the wildlife center I worked at in Iowa who was a hit by a car and had head trauma. And one of his incisors was fractured, but it also got pushed and shoved up into his sinus cavity.
Okay.
And so then he had chronic sneezing and nasal discharge.
Sure.
From that, you know, because that now that tooth is up in there, the body's like, what are you? Get out of my space. You don't belong here. So then it's just, you know, laying down inflammation and mucus production. And so that animal had chronic respiratory symptoms. So the only way to resolve that is to pull that tooth.
Right.
But then we can't release that animal, right? But that animal did get placed. And again, this was 20 years ago. So it may be a different story today. We've just changed our practices. But, you know, back then we placed a lot of things.
Sure.
And if they couldn't be released, you went to a zoo or a nature center. But, you know, he's going to obviously need chronic dental work because now he's missing that incisor.
Right.
But so we do have to take that into mind, too, of when we have blunt force trauma to the face, don't ignore the eyes, don't ignore the nasal cavity, because if we have damage to those areas, we'll have chronic issues with that. And even with squirrels sometimes, you know, one of the most common traumas we see with baby squirrels is they fall out of their nest.
Yeah, head first.
30, 40 feet out of a tree, smack onto the ground and come in with, you know, facial swelling or a bloody nose. And at that point, when we look at them, we're like, oh, your teeth look fine. We always do, you know, oral exam. Let's look at your incisors. Oh, they look fine. But what can happen is they can actually get that blunt force trauma to the tooth that can affect the root of the tooth. And then their teeth are normal. And then all of a sudden they start growing in abnormal. And so those guys that come in with known facial trauma, epistaxis, which is bloody nose, we monitor them for several weeks as their teeth continue to grow in to make sure that they're growing in correctly before we call it good and release them.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah.
So I'm things learning so much. Yeah. This is so amazing.
Good.
For a wildlife rehabilitator.
Yeah.
If you get an animal in, you can't get to your vet right away or whatever.
Sure.
As far as doing an oral exam, do you have some pro tips? Do you have some ideas?
Right. So saying if you don't have like access to sedation.
Exactly.
Is that what you're thinking?
Right away. And that's me,
right?
I get them after hours when my vet is not at the office. And, you know, I'm like, okay, it's 8 o'clock at night. And,
right,
you know, what can I do now.
You do your best, and you know that may be a quick visual if they're opening their mouth and screaming at you or trying to drool at you. So you might be able to get a visual. Sometimes too, what I will do is if you have someone to hold the animal, you know, be careful, right? You don't want to get bit. But I will take like a tongue depressor and lift the lip with that so I can get a good look at like the canines and the incisors. But, you know, you're probably just going to have to wait until you can get them under sedation to really look back at those premolars and molars. So do your best with what you got,
right?
If you do suspect there's some oral trauma there or broken teeth, you know, make sure you're addressing their pain.
Right. So that's a call out to make sure that you're working with your vet to have some really good standard operating procedures or SOPs in place so that if it is 8 or 9 o'clock at night, that you already have instructions in place so you know what to do in different situations.
Yeah.
And that's really pretty easy to do long before you get that injured baby squirrel that has fallen on his poor little face.
Yes.
30, 40 feet in the air and from... You know, its nest, that kind of thing. So, So, one of the questions.
Yeah.
Why? Because I've had this done recently.
Oh.
So, you know. Okay. Root canals.
Yeah. Yes. So, root canals are an option for animals. The thing with root canals, so when you do a root canal, you know, kind of the question is, why would you do a root canal versus an extraction? So, with a root canal, you can save the tooth. Okay, so let's say you have a fractured canine. Maybe it's not badly fractured. It's just at the tip, but there is pulp exposed. And so we either need to extract or we need to do a root canal. With a root canal, really best practice is if that procedure is going to be performed, that tooth needs to be monitored. So, you know, if we're doing a root canal and say a dog, ideally we would check it, you know, every 12 to 18 months and make sure that the tooth is doing okay, that the tooth is still viable, that there's no issues for that pet. Well, we don't have people out in the wild to monitor these guys if we do a root canal, you know, unless they're going to go to a placement option. And then again, you have to make sure they're going to be monitored appropriately.
Exactly.
So typically, we will not perform root canals on wild animals that are going to be released. Extraction is the best option for that case.
Right, yeah, because you can't follow up.
Right, yeah. And that follow-up is important. If it's something that needs follow-up, then, you know, if you can't achieve that, then euthanasia is the best option.
Right.
And I just, you know, I know it's easy to be like, well, they'll probably be okay. Or, you know, their lifespan's only a year or two in the wild, so they don't really have long enough to develop a problem and we're going to release them anyway. Really make sure you're advocating for what's best for that animal.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, we're advocating for them and we have to advocate for them, whether it's pain management in captivity, but also for euthanasia.
For their future.
And for their future, right?
Yeah, we want to set these animals up for success. And so that's why we have these, you know, or we should have these strict criteria, pre-release criteria, you know. And one of those criteria is that they need to be able to hunt. Okay, well, we got to have a healthy mouth to do that. Okay, we need to be able to reproduce. Okay, well, in some species, we need to have a healthy mouth to do that. We got to be able to do all the functions that that animal needs to do to survive, you know, whether it be running, you know, hopping, flying, balancing, whatever. And that includes gathering things for making nests and dens. Well, you got to have a healthy mouth to do that. So if you really look at all your criteria for release, your healthy mouth falls into every one of those categories.
Yes.
And if we're ignoring the mouth and not paying good attention to it and the health of the mouth, then we're not doing justice for that animal.
Right.
And we're just setting them up for more problems or failure altogether.
Yeah, failure, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We want to put them out there at this, what I call the same age and same conspecific, where wild animals at that level are at. They don't need to be better, but we definitely don't want them at a disadvantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? We want to put them out there at the same level.
Yeah.
Having those, like you said, the tooth problems might set them up for failure instead of...
Success. Well, and I think too, you know, oftentimes, I think of our physical exam in general on wild animals, the mouth is probably the one area that gets kind of skipped over the most. And I think a lot of it's just not access to the sedation that we need to get a good oral exam. So it's just kind of like, it's probably fine. So that's why it's so important to really, you know, work with your vet to try to make sure you are able to sedate these animals and get that good oral exam. We shouldn't just be ignoring it because we can't examine it, right?
Right.
And, you know, of course, the more we look, the more we find, but that's good. That's good medicine. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. We don't want to just kind of push it to the side and ignore it, because again, then we're just not doing justice for that animal and, right, you know, what's best for them. So really try to figure out a way that you are able to accomplish that good oral exam, mm-hmm, and make sure that is part of your physical, you know, every time you're doing one.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite case?
That might be a little
hard.
Oh my gosh. This might be the hardest question.
I mean, the bat was pretty cool, doing the bat dental, since that was my first bat and my smallest critter that I'd ever worked on. I do a lot of opossums. That's the most common one that I've done work on, and I've done some red fox. But I would say the coyote was probably my favorite. Sure. And, you know, again, he needed multiple extractions, but I'm fascinated with coyotes. I love them. I think they're great. And they get a bad rap. And, you know, there's a lot of discussions about coyotes where I live, especially. But I think that was probably my most rewarding dental procedure, just because he did need so much done and he did so fabulously after. That was probably my favorite case so far.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah, very, very fascinating. Mm-hmm. So if someone listening is like, I am getting really interested in dentistry.
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
Yeah. I am. Teeth are great. Teeth are fun.
Absolutely amazing.
Yes.
Are there,
whether it's good resources, or how do you find, if you're a veterinarian especially, right, how do you find a mentor?
Yeah.
How do you get more experience,
right,
get more information?
Yes. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good wildlife-specific dentistry resources. You know, there's a lot out there with dogs and cats, and that's kind of what I tend to go towards is, you know, canine and feline dentistry, and then obviously extrapolating that to wildlife species, because it's all very, very relative, very similar.
Sure.
And so, you know, and that's a question I get a lot is, okay, when you're extracting opossum tooth, is it like a cat or a dog? Yeah, it's exactly like a cat or a dog. So the skills I've learned, the knowledge I have with, you know, cats and dogs, I definitely can carry over into my wildlife species. With exotics, there are some good resources for at least exotics, for rabbits and rodents. Okay. So there are some good textbooks. So Quisenberry has a textbook, Ferrets, Rabbits, and Rodents, that has a dentistry section in there.
Okay.
And I believe there are a couple texts that focus more on dentistry and exotics. So that would be a good resource to go to extrapolate to like wild rabbits and rodents,
sure,
just for like dentition, anatomy,
right,
you know, things like that. And you know, finding that good mentor is very important, because, you know, number one, they just get you excited about teeth.
Right.
All right. And it's just nice to have that person to kind of lean on when you have questions. So I still reach out to Danelle and say, hey, I'm struggling with this. What am I doing wrong? What could I be doing differently?
Sure.
Can you help me out? You know, why is this happening? Or, and, you know, she'll write back and give me some great tips, and that's really helped me. And then, you know, for veterinarians, there are a lot of different dental wet labs and workshops that you can sign up for that have been hugely helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
Those have been great, because they're board certified dentists that are teaching those, and you learn a lot of different techniques that can be used for wildlife. And then, honestly, practicing. So I would actually, you know, keep cadaver heads,
sure,
of animals that we had euthanized at WRC and practice on those. And
sure,
really, that's dentistry, really just takes practice. You just got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can read about it all day long, but for me, I'm a very hands-on learner.
Sure.
So if I can actually sit down and do it, that is going to help me a lot more than just reading about it.
Right.
And I highly recommend that for, you know, veterinarians that want to get more involved in dentistry. Is it can be very intimidating at first, and I admit I was intimidated at first too, but the more I've learned about it and the more workshops I've done, and what's nice about going to different workshops is that everybody does things maybe slightly different, and you get little nuggets from each one of like, oh, this person, you know, elevates their gingiva this way, I'm going to try that next time, or they do this or do that, and all these little things you can kind of take in and then find your groove and your way of doing things. And so I highly advise trying to get out there and do some hands-on work and practice on cadaver heads as much as you can, and, you know, or even like volunteer at a local shelter where they have pets that need dental work done, and
right,
you can, you know, work on those guys. The more you do it, the more comfortable you'll be and the more confident you'll be, you know, to do wildlife or to take on a bat.
What a place to kind of wrap up here. But if people did have questions,
yes,
can they email you?
Absolutely. Please email me. I am happy to answer questions. I'm happy to consult on cases. Send me some photos. It'd be super helpful if you can get photos of the area of concern so that I can get a better idea what's going on. And yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. Yeah. We will make sure that your email is in the show notes.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, I cannot even thank you enough. This has been so much fun.
Yes.
I've learned a lot.
Good.
And yes, you've made me much more excited about tea.
Fabulous.
Than I was before.
Good.
So thank you.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Leslie.
Of course.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release Season 2. That was Dr. Leslie Reed, a Minnesota-based veterinarian who divides her time between domestic small animal medicine and wildlife dentistry. This concludes Season 2. That went by fast, didn't it? It certainly did for me, and I loved every minute of it. As I mentioned at the top, we're currently working on topics for Season 3. If you have ideas, please let me know. You can email me at gailbuell@umn.edu. I would love to hear from you. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the Partnership Coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Clocky. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. Leslie Reed. Also to Partners for Wildlife and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.